The Dunwich Horror itself came between Lammas and the Equinox in 1928, and Dr. Armitage was among those who witnessed its monstrous prologue. He had heard, meanwhile, of Whateley's grotesque trip to Cambridge and of his frantic efforts to borrow or copy from the Necronomicon at Widener Library. Those efforts had been in vain, since Armitage had issued warnings of the keenest intensity to all librarians having charge of the dreaded volume. Wilbur had been shockingly nervous at Cambridge, anxious for the book, yet almost equally anxious to get home, as if he feared the results of being away long. Early in August, the half-expected outcome developed, and in the small hours of the third, Dr. Armitage was awakened suddenly by the wild, fierce cries of the savage watchdog on the college campus. Deep and terrible, the snarling, half-mad growls and barks continued, always in mounting volume, but with hideously significant pauses. Then there rang out a scream from a wholly different throat, such a scream as roused half the sleepers of Arkham and haunted the dreams ever after. Such a scream as could come from no being born of earth or wholly of earth. Armitage, hastening into some clothing and rushing across the street and lawn to the college buildings, saw that others were ahead of him and heard the echoes of a burglar alarm still shrilling in the out library. An open window shewed black and gaping in the moonlight. What had come had indeed completed its entrance, for the barking and the screaming, now fast fading into a mixed low growling and moaning, proceeded unmistakably from within. Some instinct warned Armitage that what was taking place was not a thing for unfortified eyes to see, so he brushed back the crowd with authority as he unlocked the vestibule door. Among the others he saw Professor Warren Rice and Dr. Francis Morgan, men to whom he had sold some of his conjectures and misgivings, and these two he motioned to accompany him inside. The inward sounds, except for a watchful droning whine from the dog, had by this time quite subsided, but Armitage now perceived with a sudden start that a loud chorus of whippoorwills among the shrubbery had commenced a damnably rhythmic piping, as if in unison with the last breaths of a dying man. The building was full of a frightful stench, which Dr. Armitage knew too well, and the three men rushed across the hall to the small genealogical reading room whence the low whining came. For a second, nobody dared to turn on the light. Then Armitage summoned up his courage and snapped the switch. One of the three, it is not certain which, shrieked aloud at what sprawled before them amongst distorted tables and overturned chairs. Professor Rice declares that he wholly lost consciousness for one instant, though he did not stumble or fall. The thing that lay half bent on its side in a fetid pool of greenish yellow ichor and tarry stickiness was almost 9 feet tall, and the dog had torn off all of the clothing and some of the skin. It was not quite dead, but twitched silently and spasmodically, while its chest heaved in monstrous unison with the mad piping of the expectant whippoorwills outside. Bits of shoe leather and fragments of apparel were scattered around the room, and just inside the window an empty canvas sack lay, where it had evidently been thrown. Near the central desk a revolver had fallen, a dented but undischarged cartridge later explaining why it had not been fired. The thing itself, however, crowded out all other images at the time. It would be trite and not wholly accurate to say that no human pen could describe it, but one may properly say that it could not be vividly visualized by anyone whose ideas of aspect and contour are too closely bound up with the common life forms of this planet, and of the three known dimensions. It was partly human, beyond a doubt, with very man-like hands and head, and the goatish, chinless face had the stamp of the Whateleys upon it. But the torso and lower parts of the body were teratologically fabulous, so that only generous clothing could have ever enabled it to walk on earth unchallenged or uneradicated. Above the waist it was semi-anthropomorphic, though its chest, where the dog's rending paws still rested watchfully, had the leathery, reticulated hide of a crocodile or alligator. The back was piebald with yellow and black, and dimly suggested the squamous coverings of certain steaks. Below the waist, though, it was the worst, for here all human resemblance left off and sheer fantasy began. The skin was thickly covered with coarse black fur, and from the abdomen a score of long greenish-grey tentacles with red sucking mouths protruded limply. Their arrangement was odd, and seemed to follow the symmetries of some cosmic geometry unknown to Earth or the solar system. On each of the hips, deep set in a kind of pinkish ciliated orbit, was what seemed to be a rudimentary eye, whilst in lieu of the tail there depended a kind of trunk or feeler with purple annular markings, and with many evidences of being an undeveloped mouth or throat. The limbs, save for their black fur, roughly resembled the hind legs of prehistoric Earth's giant saurians, and terminated in ridgy veined pads that were neither hooves nor claws. When the thing breathed, its tail and tentacles rhythmically changed colour, as if from some circulatory cause non-normal to the non-human side of its ancestry. In the tentacles, this was observable as a deepening of the greenish tinge, while in the tail it was manifest as a yellowish appearance which alternated with a sickly greyish white in the spaces between the purple rings. Of genuine blood, there was none. Only the fetid greenish-yellow ichor which trickled along the painted floor beyond the radius of the stickiness and left a curious discoloration behind it. As the presence of the three men seemed to rouse the dying thing, it began to mumble without turning or raising its head. Dr. Armitage made no written record of its mouthing, but asserts confidently that nothing in English was uttered. At first the syllables defied all correlation from speech on Earth, but towards the last there came some disjointed fragments evidently taken from the Necronomicon, that monstrous blasphemy in quest of which the thing had perished. These fragments, as Armitage recalls them, ran something like Nagai, Nagaga, Bugshogog, Yaha, Yog-Sothoth, Yog-Sothoth. They trailed off into nothingness as the whippoorwill shrieked in rhythmic crescendos of unholy anticipation. Then came a halt in the gasping, and the dog raised its head and a long, lugubrious howl. A change came over the yellow, goatish face of the prostrate thing, and great black eyes fell in appallingly. Outside the window, the shrilling of the whippoorwills had suddenly ceased, and above the murmurings of the crowd gathered there came the sound of a panic-struck whirring, a fluttering. Against the moon, vast clouds of feathery watchers rose and raced from sight, frantic at that which they had sought for prey. All at once the dog started up abruptly, gave a frightened bark, and leapt nervously out of the window by which it had entered. A cry rose from the crowd, and Dr. Armitage shouted to the men outside that no one must be admitted till the police or medical examiner came. He was thankful that the windows were just too high to permit of peering in, and drew the dark curtains carefully down over each one. By this time, two policemen had arrived, and Dr. Morgan, meeting them in the vestibule, was urging them for their own sake to postpone entrance to the stench-filled reading room till the examiner came and the prostrate thing could be covered up. Meanwhile, frightful changes were taking place on the floor. One need not describe the kind and rate of shrinkage and disintegration that occurred before the eyes of Dr. Armitage and Professor Rice. But it is permissible to say that, aside from the external appearance of face and hands, the really human element in Wilbur Whately must have been very small. When the medical examiner came, there was only a sticky, whitish mass on the painted boards, and the monstrous odour had nearly disappeared. Apparently, Whately had no skull or bony skeleton, at least in any true or stable sense. He had taken somewhat after his unknown father. Yet, this was only the prologue of the actual Dunwich horror. Formalities were gone through by bewildered officials, Abnormal details were duly kept from the press and public, and men were sent to Dunwich and Aylesbury to look up property and notify any who might be heirs of the late Wilbur Whately. They found the countryside in great agitation, both because of the growing rumblings beneath the domed hills and because of the unwanted stench and the surging, lapping sounds which came increasingly from the great empty shell formed by Whately's boarded-up farmhouse. Earl Sawyer, who tended the horse and cattle during Wilbur's absence, had developed a woefully acute case of nerves. The officials devised excuses not to enter the noisome boarded place, and were glad to confine the survey to the deceased living quarters. The newly mended sheds to a single visit. They filed a ponderous report on the Cult House in Aylesbury, and litigations concerning heirship are said to still be in progress amongst the innumerable Whately's, decayed and undecayed, of the upper Miskatonic Valley. An almost interminable manuscript in strange characters, written in a huge ledger and adjusted as sort of a diary because of the spacing and the variations in ink and penmanship, presented a baffling puzzle to those who found it on the old bureau which served as its owner's desk. After a week of debate, it was sent to Miskatonic University, together with the deceased collections of strange books for study and possible translation. But even the best linguist soon saw that it was not likely to be unriddled with ease. No trace of the ancient gold with which Wilbur and old Whately always paid their debts has yet to be discovered. It was in the dark of September 9th that the horror broke loose. The hill noises had been very pronounced during the evening, and the dogs barked frantically all night. Early risers on the 10th noticed a particular stench in the air. After 7 o'clock, Luther Brown, a hired boy at George Corey's, and between Cold Spring Glen and the village, rushed frenziedly back from his morning trip to Ten Acre Meadow with the cows. He almost convulsed with fright as he stumbled into the kitchen and then the yard outside, with no less frightened herd were pawing and lowing pitifully, having followed the boy back into the panic they shared with him. Between gasps, Luther tried to stammer out his tale to Mrs. Corey. "Up there, beyond Glen, Miss Corey, there's something been there. It smells like thunder, and all the bushes and little trees is pushed back from Rudd, like their house been moved along it. And that ain't the worst, neither. These prints in the Rudd. Miss Corey, great road prints as big as barrel heads. All sunk down like an elephant, only to be along. Only there's a sight more nor 4 feet could make. I looked down at one or two afore I ran, and I see every one was covered with lines spreading about one place, like as if big palm leaves fans. 2 or 3 times as big as they is, had have been pounded down in Rudd, and the smell was awful, like what's around Wizard Whately's old house." Here he faltered, and seemed to shiver afresh with the fright that had sent him flying home. Mrs. Corey, unable to extract more information, began telephoning the neighbours, thus starting on its rounds the overture of panic that heralded the major terrors. When she got Sally Sawyer, housekeeper at Seth Bishop's, the nearest place to Whately's, it became her turn to listen instead of transmit, for Sally's boy Chauncey, who slept poorly, had been up on the hill towards Whately's and had dashed back in terror after one look at the place, at the pasturage where Mr. Bishop's cows had been left all night. "Yes, Miss Corey," came Sally's tremulous voice over the party line. "Chancey, he just come back a-postin' and couldn't have talk for being scared. He says all Whately's house is all blowed up, but with the timbers scattered round like there'd been dynamite inside. Only the bottom floor ain't, though. But it's all covered with all tar-like stuff that smells awful and drips down over the edges, out in the ground where the side timbers are all blown away. And there's awful kinder marks in the yard, too. Great round marks, bigger round than a hogshead, and all sticky with stuff like it's all blowed up house. Chauncey, he says, they leads off into the meadows with a great swath wider and the barn is metted down. and all the stunned walls tumbled every which way where it goes. And he says, Miss Corey, as how he sought look for Seth the cows, frightened as he was, and found him up in the pasture night in Devil's Hop Yard in an awful shape. Half of him's clean gone, and now half of them that's left is sucked up most of dry of blood, with sores on them like they've been on Waitley's cattle ever since Lavinia's black brat was born. Seth, he's gone out now to look after him, though I'll vow you wouldn't care to get very nigh with just Waitley's. Chance he don't look careful to see what the big matted down swath led after it left the pasturage, but he says thinks it pinted towards Glen Rudd to the village. I tell you, Miss Corey, there's something abroad that hadn't been utter abroad, and I for one think that Black Wilbur Waitley has come to the bad end he deserved, is at the bottom of the breeding of it. He wasn't all human hisself, I say to everybody, and I think he and all Waitley must have raised something in that there nailed up house, as even so humans as he was. They all have been unseen things around Dunwich, living things, as ain't human and ain't good for human folks. The ground was talking last night, and toward morning Chancy he heard whippoorwills so loud in Colspring Glen he couldn't sleep none, and he thought he heard another faint like surround over towards Wizard Waitley's, a kind of a ripping or tearing of wood, like some bigger box or crate were being ripped open. Was with this and that, he didn't get to sleep at all since sun up, and no sooner was he up this morning, but he's got to go over to Waitley's and see what the matter. You see enough, I tell ye, Miss Corey, that don't mean no good, and I think as all men folk ought to get up and party and do something. I know something awful is about. I feel my time is nigh, though my God knows just what it is. Did your Luther take account of where them big tracks led to? Now? Well, Miss Corey, if there was on the Glen Rudd this side of the glen, and ain't nobody got on your house yet, I calculate they must have gone into the glen itself. It would do that. I always say Coldspring Glen ain't no healthy nor decent place. The whippoorwills and fireflies, they never did act like creators of God. And they's them and says ye kin hear strange things are rushing and are talking in the air down there if you stand in the right place, atween the rock falls and bear's den. By that noon, fully three quarters of the men and boys of Dunwich were trooping over the roads and meadows between the new-made Waitley ruins and Coldspring Glen, examining in horror the vast monstrous prints that maimed Bishop Cattle, the strange noisome wreck of the farmhouse, and the bruised matted vegetation of the fields and roadsides. Whatever had burst loose upon the world had assuredly gone down into that great sinister ravine, for all the trees and the barks were bent and broken, and a great avenue had been gouged in the precipice hanging underbrush. It was as though a house, launched by an avalanche, had slid down through the tangled growths of the almost vertical slope. From below, no sound came, but only a distant, undefinable fainter. And it is not to be wondered at that the men preferred to stay on the edge and argue, rather than descend and beard the unknown cyclopean horror in its lair. Three dogs that were with the party had barked furiously at first, but seemed cowed and reluctant when near the glen. Someone telephoned the news to the Aylesbury Transcript, but the editor, accustomed to wild tales from Dunwich, did no more than concoct a humorous paragraph about it, an item soon afterwards reproduced by the Associated Press. That night everyone went home, and every house and barn were barricaded as stoutly as possible. Needless to say, no cattle were allowed to remain in open pasturage. About 2 a.m, a frightful stench and the savage barking of the dogs awakened the household at Elmer Fry's, on the eastern edge of Coldspring Glen, and all agreed that they could hear a sort of muffled swishing or lapping sound from somewhere outside. Mrs. Fry proposed telephoning the neighbours, and Elmer was about to agree when the noise of splintering wood burst in upon their deliberations. It came, apparently, from the barn, and was quickly followed by a hideous screaming and stamping amongst the cattle. The dog slavered and crouched close to the feet of the fear-numbed family. Fry lit a lantern through force of habit, but knew it would be death to go out into the black farmyard. The children and the woman folk whimpered, kept from screaming by some obscure vestigial instinct of deference, which told them that their lives depended on silence. At last the noise of the cattle subsided to a pitiful moan, and a great snapping, crashing and crackling ensued. The Fries, huddled together in the sitting room, did not dare to move until the last echoes died away, far down in the cold spring glen. Then, amidst the dismal moans from the stable and the demonic piping of late whippoorwills in the glen, Selina Fry trotted to the telephone and spread what news she could of the second phase of the horror. The next day, all the countryside was in a panic, and cowed, uncommunicative groups came and went where the fiendish thing had occurred. Two titan swathes of destruction stretched from the glen to the Fry farmyard. Monstrous prints covered in the bare patches of ground, and one side of the old red barn completely caved in. Of the cattle, only a quarter could be found and identified. Some of those were in curious fragments, and all that survived had to be shot. Earl Sawyer suggested that help be asked from Aylesbury or Arkham, but others maintained it would be of no use. Old Zebulon Whateley of the branch that hovered about halfway between soundness and decadence made darkly wild suggestions about rites that ought to be practised on the hilltops. He came of a line where tradition ran strong, and his memories of chantings in the great stone circles were not altogether connected with Wilbur and his grandfather. Darkness fell upon a stricken countryside too passive to organise for real defence. In a few cases, closely related families would band together and watch in the gloom under one roof, but in general there was only a repetition of the barricading of the night before, and a futile, ineffective gesture of loading muskets and setting pitchforks handily about. Nothing, however, occurred again except some hill noises, and when the day came there were many who hoped that the new horror had gone as swiftly as it had come. There were even bold souls who proposed an offensive expedition down in the glen, though they did not venture to set an actual example to the still reluctant majority. When night came again, the barricading was repeated, though there was less huddling together of families. In the morning, both the Fry and the Seth Bishop's household reported excitement among the dogs and vague sounds and stenches from afar, while early explorers noted with horror a fresh scent of the monstrous tracks in the road skirting Sentinel Hill. As before, the sides of the road shewed a bruising indicative of the blasphemously stupendous bulk of the horror, while the confirmation of the track seemed to argue a passage in two directions, as if the moving mountain had come from Coldspring Glen and returned to it along the same path. At the base of the hill, a 30-foot swath of crushed shrubbery saplings led steeply upwards, and the seekers gasped when they saw that even the most perpendicular places did not deflect the inexorable trail. Whatever the horror was, it could scale a sheer stony cliff of almost complete verticality, and as the investigators climbed around to the hill's summit by a safer route, they saw the trail ended, or rather reversed there. It was here that the Whateleys used to build their hellish fires and chant their hellish rituals by the table-like stone on May Eve and Hallowmas. Now that very stone formed the centre of a vast space thrashed around by the mountainous horror, while upon its slightly concave surface was a thick and fetid deposit of the same tarry stickiness observed on the floor of the ruined Whateley farmhouse where the horror escaped. Men looked at one another and muttered. Then they looked down the hill. Apparently the horror descended by a route much the same as that of its ascent. To speculate was futile. Reason, logic, and normal ideas of motivation stood confounded. Only old Zebulon, who was not with the group, could have done justice to the situation and suggested a possible explanation. Thursday night began much like the others, but it ended less happily. The whippoorwills in the glen had screamed with such unusual persistence that many could not sleep, and about 3 a.m. all of the party telephones rang tremulously. Those who took down their receivers heard a frightened, mad voice shriek out, "Help! Oh my God!" And then some thought a crashing sound followed the breaking off of the explanation. There was nothing more. No one dared do anything, and no one knew till morning whence the call came. Then those who have heard it called everyone on the line and found that only the Fries did not reply. The truth appeared an hour later when a hastily assembled group of armed men trudged out to the Fry place at the head of the glen. It was a horrible yet hardly a surprise. There were more swathed and monstrous ruins, but there was no longer any house. It caved in like an eggshell, and amongst the ruins nothing alive or dead could be discovered. Only a stench and a tarry stickiness. The Elmer Fries had been erased from Dunwich. In the meantime, a quieter yet even more spiritually poignant phase of the horror had been blackly unwinding itself behind the closed door of a shelf-lined room in Arkham. The curious manuscript record of or diary of Wilbur Whately, delivered to Miskatonic University for translation, had caused much worry and bafflement among the experts in languages both ancient and modern. Its very alphabet, notwithstanding a general resemblance to the heavily shaded Arabic used in Mesopotamia, being absolutely unknown to any available authority. The final conclusion of the linguists was that the text represented an artificial alphabet, giving the effect of a cipher. Though none of the usual methods of cryptographic solution seemed to furnish any clue, even when applied on the basis of every tongue the writer might conceivably have used. The ancient books taken from Wheatley's quarters, while absorbing, interesting, and in several cases promising to open up new and terrible lines of research among philosophers and men of science, were of no assistance whatsoever in this matter. One of them, a heavy tome with iron clasp, was in another unknown alphabet. This one of very different cast and resembling Sanskrit more than anything else. The old ledger was at length given wholly into the charge of Dr. Armitage, both because of his peculiar interest in the Whately matter and because of his wide linguistic learning and skill in the mystical formulae of antiquity and the Middle Ages. Armitage had an idea that the alphabet might be something esoterically used by a certain forbidden cults which had come down from old times, and which have inherited many forms and tradition from the wizards of Saracenic world. The question, however, it did not deem vital, since it would be unnecessary to know the origin of the symbols if, as he suspected, they were used as a cipher in the modern language. It was his belief that, considering the great amount of text involved, the writer would scarcely have wished the trouble of using another speech other than his own, save perhaps in certain specific formulae and incantations. Accordingly, he attacked the manuscript with the preliminary assumption that the bulk of it was in English. Dr. Armitage knew, from the repeated failures of his colleague, that the riddle was a deep and complex one, and that no simple mode of solution could merit even a trial. All through late August, he fortified himself with the mass lore of cryptography, drawing upon the fullest resources of his own library, and wading night after night amidst the arcana of Trithemius's Polygraphia, Gimbatista's Portus de Fervitis Literarum Notis, de Vigniere's Traite de Chiffre, Falconer's Cryptomensis Patefacta, and Davis and Thickness's Ancient Century Treatises, and such fairly modern authorities as Blair von Martin and Kluber's Cryptographic. He dispersed his study of the books with attacks on the manuscript himself, and in time became convinced that he had to deal with one of the most subtlest and most ingenious of cryptograms, in which many separate lists of corresponding letters are arranged like the multiplication table, and the message built up with arbitrary keybirds known only to the initiated. The older authorities seemed rather more helpful than the newer ones, and Armitage concluded that the code of the manuscript was one of great antiquity, no doubt handed down through a long line of mystical experimenters. Several times he seemed near daylight, only to be set back by some unforeseen obstacle. Then, as September approached, the clouds began to clear. Certain letters, as used in certain parts of the manuscript, emerged definitely and unmistakably, and it became obvious that the text was indeed in English. On the evening of September 2nd, the last major barrier gave way, and Dr. Armitage read for the first time a continuous passage of Wilbur Wheatley's annuals. It was in truth a diary, as all had thought, and it was couched in a style clearly shewing the mixed occult erudition and general illiteracy of the strange being who wrote it. Almost the first long passage that Armitage deciphered, an entry dated November 26, 1916, proved highly startling and disquieting. It was written, he remembered, by a child of 3 1/2 who looked like a lad of 12. "Today, learned the aclo for the Sabbath," it ran, "which did not like, it being answerable from the hill and not from the air. That upstair more ahead of me than I had thought it would be, and is not like to have much earth brains. Shot Elam's Hunchins' collie Jack when he wouldn't bite me, and Elam said he would kill me if he dast. I guess he won't. Grandfather kept me saying the dough formula last night, and I think I saw the inner city at the two magnetic poles. I should go to these poles when the earth is cleared off. If I can't break through with the dough na formula when I commit it, they from the air told me Sabbat that it would be years before I can clear off the earth, and I guess grandfather would be dead then. So I have to learn all the angles of the planes and all the formulas between er and the ngur. They from outside will help, but they cannot take body without human blood. That upstairs looks it will have the right cast. I can see it a little when I make the vorish sign or blow the powder of Mgazi at it. And it is near like them at Mary Eve on the hill. The other face may wear off some. I wonder how I shall look when the earth is cleared, and there are no earth beings on it. He that came with the Aklo Sabbath said I may be transfigured, there being much of outside to work on. Morning found Dr. Armitage in a cold sweat of terror and frenzy of wakeful concentration. He had not left the manuscript all night, but sat at his table under the electric light, turning page after page with shaking hands as fast as he could decipher the cryptic text. He had nervously telephoned his wife. He would not be home, and when she brought him a breakfast from the house, he could scarcely dispose of a mouthful. All that day he read on, now and then halted manly as reapplication of the complex key became necessary. Lunch and dinner were brought him, but he ate only the smallest faction of either. Toward the middle of the next night he drowsed off in his chair, but soon woke out of a tangle of nightmares almost as hideous as the truths and medicine menaces to a man's existence that he had uncovered. On the morning of September 4th, Professor Rice and Dr. Morgan insisted on seeing him for a while, and departed trembling and ashen grey. That evening he went to bed, but slept only fitfully. Wednesday, the next day, he was back at the manuscript and began to take copious notes both from the current sections and from those he had already deciphered. In the small hours of that night he slept a little in an easy chair in his office, but was at the manuscript again before dawn. Sometime before noon, his physician, Dr. Hartwell, called to see him and insisted that he cease work. He refused, intimating that it was the most vital importance for him to complete the reading of the diary, and promised an explanation in due course of time. That evening, just as twilight fell, he finished his terrible perusal and sank back exhausted. His wife, bringing his dinner, found him in a half-comatose state, but he was conscious enough to warn her off with a sharp cry when he saw her eyes wander towards the notes he had taken. Weakly rising, he gathered up his scribbled papers and sealed them all in the great envelope, which he immediately placed in his inside coat pocket. He had sufficient strength to get home, but was so clearly in need of medical aid that Dr. Hartwell was summoned at once. As the doctor put him to bed, he could only mutter over and over again, "But what, in God's name, can we do?" Dr. Armitage slept, but was partly delirious the next day. He made no explanations to Hartwell, but in his calmer moments spoke of the imperative need of a long conference with Rice and Morgan. His wilder wanderings were very startling indeed, including frantic appeals that something in a boarded up farmhouse be destroyed, and fantastic references to some plan for an extirpation of the entire human race and all animals and vegetable life from the earth by some terrible elder race of beings from another dimension. He would shout that the world was in danger, since the elder things wished to strip it and drag it away from the solar system and cosmos of matter into some other plane or phase of entity from which it had once fallen, vigintillions of aeons ago. At other times he would call for the dreaded Necronomicon and the Daemon Trelea of Remigius, in which he seemed hopeful of finding some formula to check the peril he conjured up. "Stop them! Stop them!" he would shout. "Those Whateleys meant to let them in, and the worst of all is left. Tell Rice and Morgan we must do something. It's a blind business, but I know how to make the powder. It hasn't been fed since the 2nd of August, when Wilbur came here to his death, and at that rate..." Armitage had sound physique despite his 73 years and slept off his disorder that night without developing any real fever. He woke late Friday, clear of head though sober, with a gnawing fear and tremendous sense of responsibility. Saturday afternoon he felt able to go to the library and summon Rice and Morgan for a conference, and the rest of that day and evening the three men tortured their brains in the wildest speculation of the most desperate debate. Strange and terrible books were drawn voluminously from the stack shelves and from secure places of storage, and diagrams and formulae were copied with feverish haste and in bewildering abundance. Of scepticism there was none. All three had seen the body of Wilbur Whateley as it lay on the floor in the room of that very building, and after that not one of them could feel even slightly inclined to treat the diary as a madman's ravings. Opinions were divided as to notify the Massachusetts State Police, and the negative finally won. There were things involved which simply could not be believed by those who had not seen a sample, as indeed was made clear during certain subsequent investigations. Late at night, the conference disbanded without having developed a definite plan, but all day Sunday Armitage was busy comparing formulae and mixing chemicals obtained from the college laboratory. The more he reflected on the hellish diary, the more he was inclined to doubt the efficacy of any material agent in stamping out the entity which Wilbur Whateley had left behind him. The earth-threatening entity which, unknown to him, was to burst forth in a few hours and become the memorable Dunwich Horror. Monday was a repetition of Sunday, with Dr. Armitage for the first task in hand required an infinity of research and experiment. Further consultations of the monstrous diary brought about various changes of plan, and he knew that even in the end a large amount of uncertainty now remained. By Tuesday he had a definite line of action mapped out and believed he would try a trip to Dunwich within a week. Then, on Wednesday, the great shock came. Tucked obscurely away in the corner of the Occam Advertiser was a facetious little item from the Associated Press, telling what a record-breaking monster the bootleg whiskey of Dunwich had raised up. Armitage, half-stunned, could only telephone for Rice and Morgan. Far into the night they discussed, and the next day was a whirlwind of preparation on the part of them all. Armitage knew he would be meddling with terrible powers, yet saw that there was no other way to annul the deep and more malign meddling which others had done before him. Friday morning, Armitage, Rice and Morgan set out by motor for Dunwich, arriving at the village about 1 in the afternoon. The day was pleasant, but even in the brightest sunlight, a kind of quiet dread and portent seemed to hover about the strangely domed hills and the deep, shadowy ravines of the stricken region. Now and then on some mountain top, a gaunt circle of stones could be glimpsed against the sky. From the air of hushed fright at Osborne's store, they knew something hideous had happened, and they soon learned of the annihilation of the Elmer Fryhausen family. Throughout that afternoon, they rode around Dunwich questioning the natives concerning all that had occurred, and seeing for themselves with rising pangs of horror the drear Fry ruins with their lingering traces of the tarry stickiness, the blasphemous tracks in the Fry yard and wounded Seth Bishop cattle, and the enormous swathe of disturbed vegetation in various places. The trail up and down Sentinel Hill seemed to Armitage of almost cataclysmic significance. And he looked long at the sinister altar-like stone of the summit. At length, the visitors apprised of a party of state police, which had come from Aylesbury that morning in response to the first telephone reports of the Fry tragedy, decided to seek out the officers and compare notes as far as practicable. This, however, they found more easily planned than performed, since no sign of the party could be found in any direction. There had been five of them in the car, but now the car stood empty near the ruins of the Fry yard. The natives, all of whom had talked with the policemen, seemed at first as perplexed as Armitage and his companions. Then old Sam Hutchins thought of something and turned pale, nudging Fred far and pointing to the dank, deep hollow that yawned close by. "God," he gasped, "I told them not to go down into the glen. I never thought nobody'd do it with them tracks and all that smell and the whippoorwills and screeching down there in the dark on noonday." A cold shudder ran through natives and visitors alike, and every ear seemed strained in a kind of instinctive, unconscious listening. Armitage, now that he had actually come upon the horror and its monstrous work, trembled with the responsibility he felt to be his. Night would soon fall, and it was then that the mountainous blasphemy lumbered upon its eldritch course. Negotium perambulans in tenebris. The old librarian rehearsed the formula he had memorized and clutched the paper containing the alternative one he had not memorized. He saw that his electric flashlight was in working order. Rice, beside him, took from a valise a metal sprayer of the sort used in combating insects, while Morgan uncased the big game rifle on which he relied despite his colleague's warning that all with no material weapon would be of help. Armitage, having read this hideous diary, knew painfully well what kind of manifestation to expect, but he did not add to the fright of the Dunwich people by giving any hints or clues. He had hoped that it might be conquered without any revelation to the world of the monstrous thing it had escaped. As the shadows gathered, the natives commenced to disperse homeward, anxious to bar themselves indoors despite the present evidence that all human locks and bolts were useless before a force that could bend trees and crush houses when it chose. They shook their heads at the visitors' plan to stand guard at the Fry ruins near the glen. As they left, they had little expectancy of ever seeing the watchers again. There were rumblings under the hill that night, and the whippoorwills piped threateningly. Once in a while, a wind sweeping up out of Cold Spring Glen would bring a touch of ineffable fetor to the heavy night air. Such a fetor that all three of the watchers had smelled once before when they stood above a dying thing that had passed for 15 years and a half as a human being. But the looked-for terror did not appear. Whatever was down there in the glen was biding its time, and Armitage told his colleagues it would be a suicidal to try and attack it in the dark. Morning came wanly, and the night sounds ceased. It was grey, bleak day with now and then a drizzle of rain and heavier clouds seeming to be piling themselves up beyond the hills to the northwest. The men from Arkham were undecided what to do, seeking shelter from the increasing rainfalls beneath one of the few undestroyed Fry buildings. They debated the wisdom of waiting or of taking the aggressive and going down into the glen in quest of their nameless, monstrous quarry. The downpour waxed in heaviness and distant peals of thunder sounded from far horizons. Sheet lightning shimmered, and then a forky bolt flashed near at hand, as if descending into the accursed glen itself. The sky grew very dark, and the watchers hoped that the storm would prove a short, sharp one, followed by clear weather. It was still gruesomely dark when, not much over an hour later, a confused babel of voices sounded down the road. Another moment brought a view of a frightened group of more than a dozen men, running, shouting, and even whimpering hysterically. Someone in the lead began sobbing words, and the Arkham men started violently when those words developed a coherent form. "Oh, my God," the voice choked out. "It's a going again, and this time by day. It's out and moving this very minute, and only the Lord knows when it'll be on us all." The speaker panted into silence, but then another one took up his message. "Nigh on an hour ago, Zeb Whateley, he heard the phone a ringing, and it was Miss Corey, George's wife, that lives down the junction. She said the hired boy Luther was out driving in the cows from the storm after the big bolt, when he sees all the trees a-bending in the mouth of the glen opposite side to this, and smelt the same awful smell like he smelt when he found the big tracks last Monday morning. And he says they were swishing, lapping sound more nor the bending trees and bushes would make, and all of a sudden the trees along the road began to tear and get pushed aside, and there was awful stomping and splashing in the mud. But mind ye, Luther, he didn't see nothing at all, only see the bending trees and underbrush. Then far ahead, when Bishop's Brook goes under the road, he heard an awful creaking and straining on the bridge, and says he could tell the sound of wood a starting to crack and a split, and all the while he never did see a thing. Only them trees or bushes are bending. And when the swishing sound got very far off on the road towards Wizard Whateley's and Sentinel Hill, Luther, he had guts to step up where he heard it first and look at the ground. It was all mud and water, and the sky was dark, and the rain was whipping out, and the tracks about as far as it could be. But beginning at the glen mouth where the trees had moved, there was still some of them awful prints as big as barley's of what he'd seen on Monday." At this point, the first excited speaker interrupted. "But that ain't the trouble now. That was only the start. Zeb here was calling folks up and nobody was listening. And when the call came from Seth Bishop's cutting, his housekeeper Sally was carrying fit to kill. She just seed the trees all bending beside the road and said there was kind of mushy sound, like an elephant puffing, treading, a-heading for the house. Then she up and spoke, sudden and fearful smell, and said her boy Chancey was screaming and how it was just like what he smelt up in Whateley's room this morning. And the dog was barking and whining awful. And then she let out a terrible yell, and the shed down the road, she just caved in like the storm had blown it over. Only the wind wasn't strong enough to do that. Everyone was a-listening, and we could hear lots of folks on the wire a-gasping. All told, Sally, she yelled again and said that the front yard picket fence had crumbled up, although there were no sign of what had done it. Then everyone on the line could hear Chancey and old Seth Bishop yelling to Sally, was shrieking about that something heavy had struck the house, not light nor nothing but something heavy against the front that kept a launching itself again and again, though you could see nothing out from the front windows. And then
lines of fright deepened on every face, and Armitage, shaken as he was, had barely poise enough to prompt the speaker.
"And then Sally, she yelled about, oh help, the house is caving in. And on the wire we could hear the terrible crashing and the whole flock of screaming. And it's like when Elmer Fry's place was took. Only was..."
The man paused, and another of the crowd spoke.
"That's not all. Not a sound nor squeak over the phone after that. Just like we heard it go all about fords and wagons, and rounded up as many able-bodied menfolk as we could get, and Corey's place, and come up here to see what you thought was best to do.
Not but what I think is the Lord's judgment for iniquities, but no mortal kin ever set aside.
Armitage saw that the time for positive action had come, and spoke decisively to the faltering group of frightened rustics. We must follow it, boys. He made his voice as reassuring as possible. I believe there's a chance of putting it out of business. You men know that these Whateleys were wizards. Well, this thing is of wizardry, and we must put down by the same means. I've seen Wilbur Whateley's diary and read some of the strange old books he used to read, and I think I know the right spell to recite to make the thing fade away. Of course, one can't be sure, but we can always take a chance. It's invisible. I knew it would be, but there's a powder in this long-distance sprayer that might make it shrew up for a few seconds. Later on, we'll try it. It's a frightful thing to have alive, but it isn't as bad as what Wilbur would have left in had he lived longer. You'll never know what the world has escaped. Now we've only this one thing to fight, and it can't multiply. It can, though, do a lot of harm, so we mustn't hesitate to rid the community of it. We must follow it, and the way to begin is to go to the place that has just been wrecked. Let somebody lead the way. I don't know your roads very well, but an idea that might be a shorter cut across lots. How about it? The men shuffled about for a moment, and then Earl Sawyer spoke softly, pointing with a grimy finger through the steadily lessening rain. I guess you can get to Sith Bishop's quickest, but cutting across lower middle here, Weedon Brook and lower place, and climbing through Carrier's Mowing and the timber lot beyond. That comes a boat on the upper road, mighty nigh Siths, and little to the other side. Armitage, with Rice and Morgan, started to walk in the directions indicated, and most of the natives followed slowly. The sky was growing lighter, and there were signs that the storm had worn itself away. When Armitage inadvertently took a wrong direction, Joe Osborne warned him and walked ahead to shoo the right one. Courage and confidence were mounting, though the twilight of the almost perpendicular wooded hill which lay towards the end of the shortcut, and amongst whose fantastic ancient trees they had to scramble as if up a ladder, put these qualities to a severe test. At length they emerged on a muddy road to find the sun coming out. They were a little beyond the Seth Bishop's place, but bent trees and hideously unmistakable tracks shewed what had passed by. Only a few moments were consumed in surveying the ruins just around the bend. It was the Fry incident all over again, and nothing dead or living was found in either of the collapsed shells which had been the Bishop house and barn. No one cared to remain there amidst the stench and tarry stickiness, but all turned instinctively to the line of horrible prints leading on towards the wrecked Whateley farmhouse and the altar crown slopes of Sentinel Hill. As the men passed the site of Wilbur Whateley's abode, they shuddered visibly and seemed again to mix hesitancy with their zeal. It was no joke tracking down something as big as a house that one could not see, but that had all the vicious malevolence of a demon. Opposite the base of Sentinel Hill, the tracks left the road, and there was a fresh bending and matting visible along the broad swathe, marking the monster's former route to and from the summit. Armitage produced a pocket telescope of considerable power and scanned the steep green side of the hill. Then he handed the instrument to Morgan, whose sight was keener. After a moment of gazing, Morgan cried out sharply, passing the glass to Earl Sawyer and indicating a certain spot on the slope with his finger. Sawyer, as clumsy as most non-users of optical devices are, fumbled a little while but eventually focused the lenses with Armitage's help. When he did so, his cry was less restrained than Morgan's had been. God almighty, the grass and bushes are moving. It's going up slow, like creeping to the top of this minute. Heaven only knows what for. Then the germ of panic seemed to spread among the seekers. It was one thing to chase the nameless entity, but quite another to find it. Spells might be all right, but suppose they weren't. Voices began questioning Armitage about what he knew of the thing, and no reply seemed quite to satisfy.
Everyone seemed to feel himself in close proximity of phases of nature and of being utterly forbidden and wholly outside of the sane experience of mankind. In the end, the three men from Arkham, old, white-bearded Dr. Armitage, stocky, iron-grey Professor Rice, and lean, youngish Dr. Morgan, ascended the mountain alone. After much patient instruction regarding its focusing and use, they left the telescope with the frightened group that remained in the road. As they climbed, they were watched closely by those among whom the glass was passed around. It was hard going, and Armitage had to be helped more than once. High above the toiling group, that great swathe trembled as its hellish maker repassed with snail-like deliberateness. Then it was obvious that the pursuers were gaining. Curtis Whateley, of the Undecayed branch, was holding the telescope when the Arkham party detoured radically from the swathe. He told the crowd that the men were evidently trying to get to a subordinate peak, which overlooked the swathe at a point considerably ahead of where the shrubbery was now bending. This indeed proved to be true, and the party was seen to gain the minor elevation only a short time after the invisible blasphemy had passed it. Then Wesley Corey, who had taken the glass, cried out that Armitage was adjusting the sprayer which Rice held, and that something must be about to happen. The crowd stirred uneasily, recalling that this sprayer was expected to give the unseen horror a moment of visibility. Two or three men shut their eyes, but Curtis Whateley snatched back the telescope and strained his vision to the utmost. He saw that Rice and the party from the party's point of vantage above and behind the entity had an excellent chance of spreading the potent power with marvellous effect. Those without the telescope saw only an instant flash of grey cloud, a cloud about the size of a moderately large building near the top of the mountain. Curtis, who held the instrument, dropped it with a piercing shriek into the ankle-deep mud of the road. He reeled and would have crumpled to the ground had not two or three of the others seized and steadied him. All he could do was moan, half inaudibly. Oh, great God, that... There was pandemonium of questioning, and only Henry Wheeler thought to rescue the fallen telescope and wipe it clean of mud. Curtis was past all coherence, and even isolated replies were almost too much for him. Big inner in the barn, all made of squirming ropes, hull thing sort of shaped like a hen's egg, bigger than anything but duns of legs like hogs' heads that have shut up where they step. Nothing solid about it, all jelly and made of separate wiggling ropes pushed close together. Great bulging eyes all over, 10 or 20 mouths of trunks sticking about all sides, big as stovepipes, all tossing and opening and shutting. All grey with kinder blue or purple rings. God in heaven, that face. Have face on top. This final memory, whatever it was, proved too much for poor Curtis, and he collapsed completely before he could say more. Fred Farr and Will Hutchins carried him to the roadside, laid him on the damp grass. Henry Wheeler, trembling, turned the rescued telescope to the mountain to see what he might. Through the lenses were discernible three tiny figures apparently running towards the summit as fast as the steep incline allowed. Only these, nothing more. Then everyone noticed a strange, unseasonable noise in the deep valley behind, and even in the underbrush of Sentinel Hill itself. It was the piping of unnumbered whippoorwills, and in their shrill chorus there seemed to lurk a note of tense and evil expectancy. Earl Sawyer now took the telescope and reported the three figures as standing on the topmost ridge, virtually level with the altar stone, but at a considerable distance from it. One figure, he said, seemed to be raising his hands above its head at rhythmic intervals, and as Sawyer mentioned the circumstance, the crowd seemed to hear a faint, half-musical sound from the distance, as if a loud chant were accompanying the gestures.
The weird silhouette on that remote peak must have been a spectacle of infinite grotesqueness and impressiveness, but no observer was in the mood for aesthetic appreciation. I guess he's saying the spell, whispered Wheeler as he snatched back the telescope. The whippoorwills were piping wildly and in singularly curious, irregular rhythm, quite unlike that of the visible ritual. Suddenly, the sunshine seemed to lessen without the intervention of any discernible cloud. It was a very particular phenomenon and was plainly marked by all. A rumbling sound seemed brewing beneath the hills, mixed strangely with a concordant rumbling which clearly came from the sky. Lightning flashed aloft, and the wondering crowd looked in vain for the portent of storms. The chanting of the men from Arkham now became unmistakable, and Wheeler saw through the glass that they were all raising their arms in rhythmic incantation. From some farmhouse far away came the frantic barking of dogs. The change in the quality of the daylight increased, and the crowd gazed upon the horizon in wonder. A purplish darkness, born of nothing more than a spectral deepening of the sky's blue, pressed down upon the rumbling hills. Then the lightning flashed again, somewhere brighter than before, and the crowd fancied that it eschewed a certain mistiness around the altar on the distant height. No one, however, had been using the telescope at that instant. The whippoorwills continued their irregular pulsation, and the men of Dunwich braced themselves tensely against some imponderable menace with which the atmosphere seemed surcharged. Without warning came these deep, cracked, raucous vocal sounds which will never leave the memory of the stricken group who heard them. Not from any human throat were they born, for the organs of men can yield no such acoustic perversions. Rather, would have one said it came from the pit itself, had not their source been so unmistakably the altar stone on the peak. It is almost erroneous to call them sounds at all, since so much of their ghastly infra-based timber spoke to dim seats of consciousness and terror far subtler than the ear, yet one must do so, since their form was indisputably, though vaguely, that of half-articulate words. They were loud, loud as the rumblings and the thunder above which they echoed, yet did they come from no visible being. And because imagination might suggest a conjectural source in the world of non-visible beings, the huddled crowd at the mountain base huddled still closer and winced as if in expectation of a blow. Yinai, yinai, thunga, yog-sothoth, rang the hideous croaking of the space. The speaking impulse seemed to falter here, as if some frightful psychic struggle were going on. Henry Wheeler strained his eye at the telescope, but only saw the three grotesquely silhouetted human figures on the peak, all moving their arms furiously in strange gestures as their incantation drew near its culmination. From what black wells of acronautic fear or feeling, from what unplumbed gulfs of extra cosmic consciousness or obscure, long latent heredity were those half articulate thunder croakings drawn? Presently they began to gather renewed force and coherence as they grew in stark, utter, ultimate frenzy. Ay, 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 ay. Nga, nga, hiya, hiya, help, help, father, father, Yog-Sothoth. But that was all. The pallid group in the road, still reeling at the indisputably English syllables that had poured thickly and thunderously down from the frantic vacancy beside that shocking altar stone, were never to hear such syllables again. Instead, they jumped violently at the terrific report which seemed to rend the hills, the deafening cataclysmic peal whose source, be it inner earth or sky, no hearer was ever able to pace. A single lightning bolt shot from the purple zenith to the altar stone, and the great tidal wave of viewless force of indescribable stench swept down from the hill to all the countryside. Trees, grass, and underbrush were whipped into a fury, and the frightened crowd at the mountain's base, weakened by the lethal fetor that seemed about to asphyxiate them, were almost hurled off their feet. Dogs howled from the distance. Green grass and foliage wilted to a curious sickly yellow-grey, and over field and over forest were scattered the bodies of dead whippoorwills. The stench left quickly, but the vegetation never came right again. To this day, there is something queer and unholy about the growths on and around that fearsome hill. Curtis Whateley was only just regaining consciousness when the Arkham men came slowly down the mountain in the beams of a sunlight once more brilliant and untainted. They were grave and quiet and seemed shaken by memories and reflections even more terrible than those which had reduced the group of natives to a state of cowed quivering. In reply to a jumble of questions, they only shook their heads and reaffirmed one vital fact. "That thing has gone forever," Armitage said. "It has been split up into what it was originally made of and can never exist again." It was an impossibility in a normal world. Only the least fraction was really matter in any sense we know. It was like its father, and most of it had gone back to him in some vague realm or dimension outside our material universe. Some vague abyss out of which only the most accursed rite of human blasphemy could ever have called him for a moment on the hills. There was a brief silence, and in that pause the scattered senses of poor Curtis Whateley began to knit back into a sort of continuity, so that he put his head to his hand with a moan. Memory seemed to pick itself up where it had left off, and the horror of the sight that had prostrated him burst in upon him again. Oh my God, that half face on top of it. That face with the red eyes and the crinkly albino hair, with no chin like the Whateleys. It was an octopus, centipede, spider kind of thing, but there was a half-shaped man's face on top of it. And it looked like Wizard Whateley's, only it was yards and yards across. He paused, exhausted, as the old group of natives stared in bewilderment, not quite crystallised into fresh terror. Only old Zebulon Whateley, who wanderingly remembered ancient things but had been silent heretofore, spoke aloud. 15 years gone, he rambled. I heard old Whateley said how some day we'd hear a child or Lavinia's calling its father's name atop a sentinel hill. But Joe Osborne interrupted him to question the Arkham men anew. What was it anyhow? And however did young Wizard Whateley call it out of the air and come from? Armitage chose his words very carefully. It was mostly a kind of force that doesn't belong in our part of space. A kind of force that acts and grows and shapes itself by other laws than those of our sort of nature. We have no business calling in such things from outside, and only very wicked people and very wicked cults ever try to. There was some of it in Wilbur Whateley himself, enough to make a devil and a precocious monster of him, and to make his passing out a pretty terrible sight. I'm going to burn his accursed diary, and if you men are wise, you'll dynamite that outer stone up there and pull down all the rings of standing stones on the other hills. Things like that brought down the beings those Whateleys were so fond of, the beings they were going to let in tangibly to wipe out the human race and to drag the earth off to some nameless place for some nameless purpose. But as to this thing we've just sent back, the Whateleys raised it for a terrible part in the doings that were to come. It grew fast and big from the same reason that Wilbur grew fast and big. But it beat him, because it had a greater share of the outsideness in it. You needn't ask how Wilbur called it out of the air.
He didn't call it. It was his twin brother. But it looked more like the father than he did.